Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 167, Questioning Buddhism.
Why can't I have my anger? People want to know. And actually, when it's ladies in Western society, and Eastern too, who want to know, like, why can't I have my anger? Usually they're going to be middle class, educated ladies. There's no good answer to them, actually. They should have their anger. Because the males who are socialized to show anger quickly and domineeringly, they feel are pushing them around, and they're probably usually right. They've been pushed around a lot. And they're socialized to accept and to be tolerant and be gentle and meek. And in a way, actually, they're more capable of being meek. They have a better, tend to have better self-control and so on. So, because they're, from a Buddhist point of view, they're more advanced, actually, the females, in my opinion. So, than males. But no generality is valid everywhere, of course. But I think the thing is, how do we define anger? I wrote a book called Anger, Oxford University Press. I think there's a German translation, other European language, Italian, I know there is, Spanish. And I was surprised that I discovered that anger really is the big word among the moralist writings, you know. In English, even back to Chaucer, and then Greeks, Plutarch, and people like that, Italians, and the Stoics. And the anger that they say is one of the seven deadly sins, and therefore really quite bad, is the one that sweeps you off your normal, rational self-control. And you become possessed by it, as they would put it. You become furioso. And then you do destructive things. And you are not effective in dealing with the situation from the moralist point of view. And Buddhist moralists would absolutely agree. The locus classicus of it is, in all Abhidharma, but in Mahayana literature, it's Shantideva's writing. And there he gives a very good analysis of it. And therefore, in English, I think when we say, what is anger, and I probably in other European languages, it is probably the degree of anger where you lose self-control and you blow up, as we say. And Shantideva's analysis of it is, you at first are frustrated when you see something happening you don't think should be happening. When something you think should be happening, you see it being prevented or blocked from being happening. You then feel frustrated. And as that frustration builds up, it becomes more and more painful to you. And then anger in the form of your own mind, in the voice of your own inner monologue, your own inner identity speaking, comes to you and says, well, you can't do anything about that because you're too weak. But if you use me and blow up and get all overheated, you'll be stronger. And you will be able to rectify this situation, either make the good thing happen or prevent the bad thing from happening. And then you blow up, and then you go after whatever it is. And however, the problem is that in some cases it may actually, to some degree, be helpful, like when you run away from something, you know. you get an adrenaline charge, you know, and you leap away from something out of fear, you know. But unfortunately, out of anger, where you go crashing into a situation, when you're not under self, any kind of control, there are studies today that say you lose 85% of your good judgment. And Shantideva also agrees, you become the tool of your anger. Your body and mind and speech become tools of your anger. And anger dominates you. Anger is like the demon that tells them what to do. You say things that you don't mean, you'll do physical things and hurt people that you didn't want to. You lose control, you become the tool of your anger, your body, speech, and mind. You hit people, you hurt people, you kill people, you hurt yourself maybe physically, you do something, bang your head on the wall, you angrily drive your car into something and get killed yourself, and or you kill someone else or hurt them badly. You break things that you value. You feel regretful afterwards. And verbally, you'll say things you don't mean, and people feel be deeply hurt, and you feel badly afterwards. And mentally, you have hostile mind, and you destroy something or someone in your mind. And all of these things have very negative results for you, as well as for the situation. They don't really have good results. Perhaps in old-fashioned warfare, you know, they say that Alexander the Great, you know, we have the expression in English of a berserker. And Alexander the Great would go berserk on the battlefield in his early battles when he still fought himself. And he would be kind of unopposable, and he would sweep people down by the dozens, you know, type of thing. Because he was just he'd be possessed by this fury, you see. So there, you know, in that kind of a, but of course, all those people he killed all get reborn, and then they come after him in the form of the Indians or the Afghanis. So. Whoever it was who finally killed him, and in other lives, you know. So in a way, from a Buddhist point of view, it never helps. It's always destructive. However, if you want to define anger as just a kind of heat, of vigor, strong energy that you feel when you see something wrong and you want to fix it, or you protest and you see something right and you eliminate opposition to that, you know, there can be like a kind of righteous, strong feelings about ethics or to help another being or something, this won't do, this won't stand, you know, where you still very able to make judgments. You can even be reserved about flipping out, you know. And that, we can make that positive. That can be positive determination. That can be willpower, you know. We can say that we're in charge of it. So then when women react angrily, and we would say speak a little angrily, say they interrupt you, you're about to say a long bunch of stupid things, and a woman sort of forcefully and rather, and you would think maybe angrily, interrupts you, but she's still cheerful. She might make a joke out of it, or she might, but after opposing you, might make you realize how silly it all was, or whatever it is, you know, because she has good humor and she's skillful. If she really has suppressed herself for a long time about some bad thing, some stupid things you are saying or whatever, and blows up at you, then, you know, both you and she will feel wounded. You know, if you have not good control of your own anger, you'll be angry back, and then it'll be a terrible fight. So the thing there is to do it quickly. And Shantideva has a beautiful thing. He says, intervene in the situation while you're still cheerful. Your good cheer is the source of your positive actions. So don't let it be eaten away by frustration. When you start being frustrated, do something about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, get away from the situation. It doesn't do any good to blow up and add being really angry and freaked out and bitter and so forth to being impotent in a situation. Just go and leave the situation. So he gives clues like that. So it doesn't just amount to suppressing your anger. Of course, the ultimate way of overcoming anger is where you don't feel angry because you feel sorry for the people who are harmful to you or who would cause you anger. So that you feel you might want to resist them and you might be forceful, but you will never be angry because you're not trying to eradicate them from the universe. You're just trying to stop them doing their stupid thing. And you somehow feel that there is some element to them that is more than that anger of theirs, you know. So that's a positive way of dealing with anger. So the best way is Shantideva's way, you know. Be vigorous, be forceful, like a martial arts person, without being angry. That's the best way of dealing with it. And be that way with anger itself, actually, finally, which is where you, the one thing in Shantideva's thing that you're allowed to be angry with is anger itself. So when you're angry with anger, then your absolute fury turns back on absolute fury, then you only can be relatively, you only act relatively in another sense, because you sort of destroy the fury that would make you act non-relationally. And therefore, the people who are most violent and terrible when they get angry are those who have left intact the sense of absolute identity. So then when their voice, inner voice says, you got to get that person, they can't, you can't be in the same world with them, you know, like the six shooter, you know, the draw, you know, like this town's not big enough for the both of us sort of routine, then those are the people who, it's, so it's really a derivative of the self-absolutizing habit pattern, the identity habit that I call. You know, it's a derivative of that anger, the real destructive anger. Okay, so that's that one. Ding. So, how can we learn to love our enemies? How can we do that? It's really difficult. And there, let's say, let's look at first of all. What is an enemy? An enemy is someone that we fear and we hate and we avoid or we want to destroy because they have harmed us or we imagine they will harm us and hurt us, and so on. So that's the enemy. And love is defined as the will to the happiness of the beloved. So I love something in the Buddhist view, at least to, and especially towards sensitive beings. In a way, even if you love your book, you don't want to see it harmed or destroyed. You know, so you don't want the book to be happy, necessarily, but you don't want to see it hurt, the book. You don't want it to be burned, destroyed, lost, etc. You want it to be kept in a good condition. But toward a person, you want that person to be free of suffering and to feel happiness. And happiness, what tends to, when you feel happy, your happiness overflows. Therefore, in a way, the secret of true love, in a way, is happiness, and the feeling that, and there is an initial happiness, even if you don't sort of think that you're feeling happy, when you're not thinking about how you're feeling, because you're so fascinated by someone that you just, all you care about is how are they, you do feel happier right away by not worrying about how you are. That's an important point that Shantideva makes, and His Holiness makes, and nowadays, and Buddha made. So being loving is makes you happy, actually. And for example, in the meditational realm of immeasurable love, the first three heavenly planes of the realm of pure form, of desire-free form, greed-free form, then they say that when you reach there, it's like this brilliant radiance of happiness that you feel. You don't really, you're not after anything, but you just feel happy from the way things are. Something like that. And precisely because you're free of a desire of thinking that you're not happy and you need something that will make you happy. That's how the immeasurable, the first dhyana, it's called, first contemplative realm, the first brahma-vihara, the first pure or divine abode. So therefore, now the enemy who harms you, why does he harm you or she harm you? Because it thinks you are blocking its happiness. So the enemy is harmful to you in an attempt to be happy. If you can sort of see that, understand that, and you want them to be happy, then you are wishing them to be in a condition where they wouldn't feel they need to get you out of their way. So it's actually practical advice from Jesus, from Buddha. It's a very practical advice. Love your enemy means you want your enemy to be happy. If your enemy is happy without being your enemy will be bored to be your enemy because they'll be too happy to bother with it. And therefore, they will no longer be your enemy and you will not have to fear them or fight them or whatever it is. So loving your enemy is a sensible thing. And it should not be misunderstood as meaning, oh, he thinks I'm in the way of his happiness, so he wants to harm me, so he's my enemy. So that means I should go and have him harm me and then he'll be happy? No, because actually by harming someone doesn't make him happy. you are actually not the one who is blocking his happiness. His own inner confusion is blocking his happiness. His not understanding his own nature is what's blocking his happiness. So it's a diversion, and it makes him more unhappy to harm you, actually, because then subliminally, subconsciously, he realizes he did a wrong thing, and he created an enemy out of you in some way, and you become a new danger for him. And you are a new danger for him. Actually, if you're an ordinary person, you'll want revenge. Even if you die, you'll be reborn seeking revenge. In the Buddhist, more sensible worldview, where life is endlessly continuous, you know, there's no notion of life becoming nothing, something, some energy, some process becoming nothing. That's considered an incoherent and unevidenced idea. And the idea of continuum of consciousness as well as physical matter and energy is considered normal and commonsensical. So, okay, so that's why you should learn. And you learn to do so by being more realistic. You don't just think of your enemy as a sharp tip of the spear coming at you. You think of the enemy as the person wielding the spear, and you see that the person is wielding that because they're forced to do so by this, that circumstance. And you knew if they were really happy enough, they would not enroll in that army. They wouldn't obey that order. They would feel too happy to bother you. And so you employ that, but you might do so at a distance, because the worst thing that would happen would be that your loving your enemy would be cut short by being killed by the spear. Although if you extremely love your enemy, even they kill you by the spear, you'd still love them, be reborn with love. You wouldn't be reborn out of revenge if you're extremely like that. And you can find this in all religious and spiritual traditions. It's not specifically Buddhist. Buddhists may be more technically analytic about it, until some kind of modern psychology that's catching up. What is the middle way? What is the middle way? We hear a lot about the middle way in Buddhism. And what is it? Well, there's at least two kinds of middle way, actually. And one of them is the middle way between, which was the first one that Buddha mentioned after his enlightenment. And he said, when I was a prince, I was very self-indulgent, and the world was very indulgent with me, and I had experienced every pleasure, and everyone catered to me, my ego and what I wanted, and etc. So I was very, very overindulged in sensory pleasure. And then when I became an ascetic and a seeker, I got into the opposite, and I decided my body was the problem, and I was going to mortify it to the absolute. I was going to seek whatever you could find, and that was enlightening about pain. And I was inflicting pain. I was damaging myself, and I was extremely self-mortifying and overly ascetical. So my first middle way was a middle way where I restrain myself from excessive sensory indulgence, and I also restrain any tendency to sort of self-punish or self-mortify. And so middle way was I live in a pleasant way of being, but I restrain from being indulged in that, and I therefore spend my focus on trying to find out my nature and find out reality and educate myself ethically, psychologically, and scientifically. And that's the middle way. That's the first middle way. Then the second middle way is the middle way that is unpacked in the Transcendent Wisdom Sutras by the Buddha, and a little bit more inchoately or hintingly even in the Theravada Suttas, the Pali Suttas. He was always into middle way there. And that is the middle way between absolutism, sometimes, or eternalism, as they sometimes call it, when you focus on the impermanence-permanence duality, and nihilism, or where you think that, well, it's not absolute, then it doesn't exist at all. And those are two extremes of worldview, that there's an absolute, like absolutist theism, absolutist self-centrism. There's all kinds of ways of perceiving things, something as absolute. And then the opposite is seeing it as really nothing. It just all dissolves into nothing. It's all nothing. And that's nihil, and there's no consequence. And that's nihilism. And there the middle way is between absolutism and nihilism. And as I said in another one of my answers, we could call it a good kind of relativism. So it's where things are relational, and there are some strong rules and relative absolutes within the relativity, but they're never absolutely absolute. And there's no nothing. Also, everything is relative, and nothing is the one thing that is not there. So it's there is no nothingness. In other words, there's a, except as a concept, and you can create a state that might seem to you like your preconception of nothingness, but it would just be in a way you're experiencing your own concept. Really, basically, you're creating a space in your mind that seems to fit your concept, reifying as something. So that's called the middle way. And then there's a school of philosophy after Nagarjuna, after he rediscovers Mahayana and he writes his famous six works and his critique and so on. And that school is called the Madhyamaka school. So, and the Madhyama means the middle, or it can also mean the center, Madhyama. And the ka part is what makes a middle, or making a middle, or taking a middle, madhyamaka. It's a ting suffix, as they say, and it gives a sense of agency. So staying to the middle or making the middle, the school is, you know, or the mental process is, depending on how the vowels are, madhyamaka. But then this may create an awkward thing in English where you don't have an ist word for it, because you can't really say he's a philosophical middleist. It sounds like some kind of disease. So I think I use the word centrist, which I think is really quite right about it. It's a centrist. It's a centrist between annihilation and absoluteness. And it's in that being that it says that there are relative absolutes, of course. You know, like don't kill. That's almost always the case. But relatively absolute means it's almost always right. Don't be violent. Don't harm. That's almost always right. Sometimes you may need to prevent someone else, for example, who's about to kill a million people or something. You can only stop them with a long shot, and you have to kill, then you should, actually. So then, in that sense, it's not absolute, but it's relatively absolute. And similarly, it's good to annihilate certain things, like bad habits. So within relativity, you can be annihilationist about negativities, okay, and then those things that are really unimportant are relatively nothing. And certain you could use such terms. So relativism is more flexible, and it's really a good thing. And then I like to say that school is a centrist school, and those who are members of the centrist school of the that has several different varieties are following the middle way, or you could call it the central way. When we think of center, we think maybe of four corners of a square or a circle, the circumference of a circle, then there's a center. Whereas middle, we think there are two things, and you're in the between, you're going down a road, and you're in the middle of the road, it's a head which has two sides. But you can also be in the center of the road, even though you never get to the end, so it's not got four sides, it's only two sides. You can still call that center. So that's the thing on that, okay? So that's the middle way, all right? Ding!
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series, Questioning Buddhism. To submit your questions, please visit bobthurman.com. Watch classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered and remixed as educational videos on YouTube. To watch these free videos, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube. Every like, subscription, comment, and view helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's episode.
You know, then there's this whole worry about celebrities and Buddhism, which people have, depending on whether they're very purist or they're maybe too casual. You know, what it might be, say, what you could call the commodification of Buddhism leads to the commodification of Buddhism. And part of that would be then where celebrity becomes really important and people want to run out and be a Buddhist because they heard Richard Gere was a Buddhist. Or they heard that Sharon Stone was a Buddhist or something. Or Sharon Stone liked the Dalai Lama. Or Sharon Stone used, while somewhat misunderstanding, the theory of karma. you know, that kind of thing. Well, you know, like everything, celebrity culture has its problems. The idea that we look to celebrities as models of what to do. But on the other hand, who was one of the first great celebrities of the ancient world? Buddha. Buddha might have been the outstanding celebrity of the ancient world, in the sense that that India was much more populous than West Asia or Europe at that time. And China, then later when it goes to China, then again, you have all the Chinese have heard of Buddha, and they call it Pho. So celebrity thing is natural in human societies. People sort of, you know, look at those who are famous for good or bad reasons. And they, if they are good reasons, then they want to be like them, and that has a positive effect. And someone who becomes famous should take that responsibility and show good examples. And often they do, actually. If they say want to stay famous for that, they can tend to do that. So the use of celebrity in sort of making Buddhism useful and known, therefore, has the same problems that it does in any other element. And but basically, one thing, which is if we really take the pledge, you know, make the pledge that we're not trying to convert people to Buddhism, we're just trying to convert them to thinking more clearly themselves as Christians, Muslims, secularists, Taoists, Jews, whatever they are, and you know, we're not trying to really do anything, promote Buddhism, but in a way, since we're dealing in societies where some people think like Buddhism is demonic or satanic, since it isn't Jesus' way, then it must be, even though it sounds like Jesus, like love your enemy, don't be angry, you know, be happy, and you know, see the flowers in the field as divine providence, etc. Think of the divine as goodness, benevolence, the universe is basically good. It sounds a lot like Buddhism, but since it isn't Christianity, they're demonic and they're satanic and all this. So in a context of that celebrities say, no, Buddhism is a good thing, it's okay, I like Buddhism. And some of them might be reluctant to say, I am a Buddhist, because they would feel maybe then they would not get the ticket buyers who would be Christians or other kinds of religious fanatics. They'd think, why do I go to this concert or this person to see this movie when this weirdo is a Buddhist? But I think that stigma is not so much there. So that's not a big question. That's an easy question, everybody. And what is the relevance of Dalai Lama in today's world? That's very important. Here, my latest book, or latest two books in a way, almost sort of popular books, that are academic translations of the Tenure, which is my life's main work, translating all the great teachings of the 17 great pundits of Nalanda, who are still celebrities today, Nagarjuna, Asanga, Vasubandhu. In the Buddhist world, they're still celebrities. And my two latest books, one was called Why the Dalai Lama Matters, His Act of Truth as the Solution for China, Tibet, and the World, was that one, which was a popular trade book, as they call it. But wasn't that tremendously popular, but was pretty popular. In the sense of the argument there was that people who purport to like the Dalai Lama as a holy man and as some kind of a charming sort of global celebrity, which he himself is, definitely, and he wins worldwide popularity concerts by journalists and things, along with the Pope and certain movie actresses and things, people like that. And I think Obama was up there a couple of times. Angela Merkel, she's up there in my popularity contest. And And yet people say about the Dalai Lama, well, he should stay out of politics. You know? He doesn't know what's going on in the world. His nonviolence has not helped Tibet all this time. He really can't do anything against the Chinese Imperium and the People's Liberation Army with nonviolence. And even some Tibetans will say that, even though they revere him and, oh, our Dalai Lama, but, you know, he should stay out of politics. His wisdom is not relevant to history and the way things are happening in the world. And so there's a kind of ignoring his role. Well, he's a Nobel Peace Prize guy, and he's just as unrealistic as the rest of the Nobel Peace Prize guys, and as the Norwegians, for that matter, in giving these Nobel Peace Prizes to people. And the world isn't like that. It's ruled by violence and militaries and hard-nosed, you know, tough people, and it's might makes right. So he should stay out of it. Well, I know. I think that was wrong in Socrates' day. You know, in his argument against Themistocles, and it's wrong today. And who is upholding the Socratic point of view that violence is destructive, and that violence leads to more violence, and that it's practical to be kind and to use dialogue to resolve conflict, and to forswear violence and let your opponent realize that your opposition has reasoning behind it, and then he has reasoning behind his position, and the two of you will try to reason it out, come up with a middle way, be centrist, you know. That's the way of dealing with it, and violence will just bring more counter-violence, and it's no good. And he's the one whose teaching is that. He is the one who is a living teacher of that Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, Taoist, Confucian teaching, indigenous people's teaching. Anywhere where they feel that their ideas and worldviews are responsible for trying to keep the peace in the world with the neighbors and so on, at whatever level it is, whether it's the family, the tribe, or the nation, the city-state, the nation, or the planet, ultimately, but or the species, whatever it is. This is the general consensus. And the Dalai Lama is the sort of world celebrity and, in a way, leader of world leaders. He's a leader, he's a political leader also, until he resigned recently, but he still is ethically and morally. A political leader of a country who's lost his country. So he's in exile. And so therefore he's a leader responsible for a country without the country. So in a way he's very vulnerable and weak. And he's been very badly displaced and badly violated, actually, and his people have. And yet he insists on responding nonviolently with the call for dialogue, with feeling there's a win-win situation with his oppressor, rather than he has to now oppress his oppressor and kill him and get rid of him and take revenge on him. He's not into that. So that makes him, and since militarism is one of our lethal problems confronting us as a world, you know, Putin and Trump sitting there could decide they really don't like each other, mutual oligarchs who get in their bunkers, thinking they might survive with a few girlfriends, press the buttons and obliterate everybody, which would actually then obliterate them too. But they so these kind of people who get so egocentric and so out of touch with reality, poor things, so frustrated because of being out of touch with reality, they're liable to be destructive of reality because they're out of touch with it. They'll delude themselves that they can escape the consequence of it. So, since that's a major problem, then the Dalai Lama's teaching about that, living proponent of the view that that is not good, is very important. And that's why he matters. And to China and Tibet in particular, in relation to that, because that's one of his primary concerns, Chinese are harming themselves by harming the Tibetans. By harming the Tibetan environment, they're harming the sources of their rivers. By cutting the Tibetan primeval forests up the river valleys, they're causing flood and siltation and horrible disasters for themselves and the overall climate. By overgrazing the Tibetan steppe for commercial meat production, they are desertifying the steppe by bringing out too many and the wrong kind of animals. And they're ruining the monsoon cycle, and they're destroying their ecology, and then so hurting themselves. So that's a very important example. And then my last book with two co-authors is called Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of His Holiness of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And this is a must read for everyone to show that he walks his talk, that he has responded nonviolently consistently in his life, that he has developed himself consistently. He didn't just sit on his laurels, I'm Dalai Lama, so I'm just enlightened no matter what I do. No, he tries to become less egocentric, less angrysome, as he puts it, less frightened of things, and more enlightened. And he definitely has succeeded. I can testify from 53 years of personal experience. He has definitely improved enormously as a Dalai Lama. He's a better Dalai Lama than he was earlier, which might seem sacrilegious to some who say, well, he always was Avalokiteshvara incarnation. It's like the Buddhist Messiah. But I don't mean that. And part of his incarnation is to incarnate in a human form where he is more or less perfectible and more or less deteriorable, imperfectible. Can go either way. So that's his kindness, to come and be more like us and then show us the way of perfecting himself, becoming wonderful and more marvelous and more appreciated by people, and therefore people more... That becomes then the credibility reasoning, evidence. But then his teaching becomes more credible if he himself has become more better by following it himself. So that's why the Dalai Lama's role is really, really important. And it's very tragic, but I hope it will be short-lived at this stage. It's been long-lived. Really, since 1950, when Mao first decided to invade Tibet, Mao and Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong decided to invade Tibet to add that to their imperium, their land base. So he's been waiting for proper treatment from the Chinese leadership for a long time. All the other world leaders who are sane like him, he's met most of them, actually, even before they were, like he met Obama as a senator. You know, he met, and then he saw him as a president, you know. He didn't meet the Bushes before they were. He met George Bush when he was a kid in the family, first family of the older Bush. But then he straight on met the older Bush. But anyway, he met Angela Merkel when she was the Secretary of Education. He met the Premier of Colombia when he was something else. In other words, he really has met it, because as a Nobel Peace Prize laureate traveling the world, most distinguished people have wanted to meet him, and they have, and they've been touched by him. So they like him, and they're kind of distressed, but they're scared, and they have to do business with China. And when China does this thing about don't talk to him or we're never going to talk to you, now that they're rich and they're throwing money around, they're foolishly ruling him, you know, they're depriving themselves of his good advice and his presence and his blessing. And the ones who are most deprived of his blessing are the Chinese themselves, who by adopting this false, which they know to be false, they say he's a splittist, he's an evil this, he's a fake Lama, but they know that's not true, actually. Xi Jinping's father was extremely fond of the Dalai Lama, for example, Xi Zhongshun, and his mother too. And so he knows that the Dalai Lama is actually a good person and wants the good of China and the Chinese people too, and doesn't have anything much that much against the leaders, although when they do harm his people, he feels it's really regrettable, and they're being really stubborn in their stupidity, harming themselves by harming other people. So his role, it couldn't be more important here in America, that we love him, is really important. And even if you take a really long view of the planet, and you see racism as a major danger, sort of the ultimate blow up of tribalism, where there can be genocides and genocide with people with nuclear weapons can lead to mutual self-destruction, you know, mutual assured destruction, actually. And so in that context, one of the great events of 20th and 21st century, begun a little bit in 19th century, is the meeting of the so-called Caucasian whitish type of people, who are really blotchy pink more than white, but anyway, they call themselves white, and the yellow people, the Chinese people, who are hugely numerous. You know, they're like 1.5 billion. And Western people, like a lot of the Indian languages are like an Indo-European language. So they're sort of the West, actually, in relation to China. So if the harmonious meeting, if the sense of mutual sense of ability for beings across races and across nations to be able to identify with each other across ethnicities where they don't want to exterminate each other. And they are going to get along, therefore, with each other as fellow human beings, which should also, of course, be extended to animals as fellow sentient beings. Then the Dalai Lama is someone who is ethnically close to the Chinese, racially, although ethnically different, so the Chinese and Tibetan are ethnically different, but close. And the Tibetans have been relating to the Chinese for thousands of years, often as enemies, but never as owners. They never think of them. They don't think of themselves as Chinese, but they can identify and relate to them. And also as a Buddhist, since Chinese were madly Buddhist for thousands of years, the Chinese people are very, very fond of the Dalai Lama, as is visible whenever he goes to Taiwan or Singapore or Chinese Chinatowns in America or Europe. He's massively popular with Chinese people. And he's very popular with Caucasian people. Russians love him. Putin just doesn't give a visa because he's scared of the Chinese policy about that at the moment. And he's alienated from the Europeans because of his aggressiveness. And so he thinks he needs the partnership of the Chinese. Although he's the Russian-Chinese mutual self-identification is not very strong indeed, actually. But so Dalai Lama is beloved everywhere. So he should be a great mediating force if China accepted him as their dear friend, as he wants to be, and he is their best friend. If they accepted him like that, the Chinese leadership, that would satisfy the Chinese people. They'd be delighted. And then he could be the best goodwill ambassador for all the foreign people, non-Chinese people, who love the Dalai Lama. It's a tragedy that they didn't wake up to this back when he got the Nobel Prize and he have access of the whole planet, including the huge Chinese part of it, which he feels very strongly connected to. And he doesn't want to split Tibet from it. Chinese have ruined lots of parts of Tibet. They've extracted and ruined. Therefore, they should rebuild, he feels that. They're a big, powerful economy. It's good for Tibet to be connected with them. They share Buddhism. It's good to be connected with them. He has lots of reasons, other than just, you know, can't fight them, to want to be connected to China, but not if they're not benevolent. The Chinese, the Tibetan patriots, you know, who wouldn't listen to the Dalai Lama's advice not to fight violently, Kambas and Amdabas, who did fight, and lost, of course, because he said they would, and there's no point in doing that. But they are capable of it, though. Dalai Lama has caused them to fight against their inner enemy, their anger and hatred and bitterness and egotism, enough at least to not continue that fight and with the terrorism and things. Since then, they haven't done that, since they had that first war of resistance in the 50s and early 60s. So he's immensely important on the planet, is my point. And everyone should read Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet, which I hope will come out in a German edition soon too, and French edition, and Czech edition, and Russian edition, and Scandinavian edition. We feel certain it will. His Holiness himself loves it, although it's not an authorized biography. We sometimes call it a graphic novel, because we cast the Dalai Lama in some situations in a heroic light where he would underplay it with his Buddhist monk, simple Buddhist monk humility. He would not claim credit for this and that thing that happened in the world during his life on his watch. And we wanted to highlight his contribution there. So it wasn't authorized, but he likes the biography. And his, even more important, his staff liked it. His secretaries and people who are often very critical things people do about the Dalai Lama. So that's the Dalai Lama role. So then last question for today is, Geshe Wangyal's role. Well, now Geshe Wangyal, Dzogchen Ledu Tsenemate, which he once told me to say anytime I ever mentioned his name in the future. And in Tibetan, it means I mention his name for a purpose. And it's a sort of Tibetan custom. Your root teacher, which is sort of like your father and mother, it's your third parent, it's your spiritual parent, you could say. You don't mention their name casually, like, because in a way, their spiritual presence, like, you know, in the Star Wars, you have Obi-Wan Kenobi hovering over there saying, Luke, trust the Force. So highly evolved being like that can remain present spiritually to the beings that they are mentoring. And so when you call on them, it kind of stirs them up in their subtle form. And so you only do it for a certain purpose, and I'm doing it because he was such a great person and because he exemplified. And especially today, in a time when, sadly, even some Tibetan teachers have joined the ranks of the gurus who have exploited their guru relationship, like the psychiatrists who have exploited their transference with the patients to have sex with them, or to exploit them financially or something, or like the priest who exploits the choir boys, or like the, you know, they've joined the long list of people who've used charisma and spiritual authority to extract worldly favors from people in a most unspiritual and unholy manner. And unfortunately, there are some Tibetans who have joined this, and it didn't just happen. In the past, there were them too. And actually, they had such beings in Tibet who they had to continuously try to police within their own system, which done basically by the students themselves, learning about Buddhism and understanding it well enough to realize when a teacher is bad, behaving badly, and using rationalizations and excuses of why they're allowed to do so, which is not that they should not be allowed to do so. They are not allowed to do so. You know, there may be exceptional things where they do something unusual, but never harmful and never abusive. So, in that light, Geshe Wangyal was a wonderful mentor. He was a wonderful model. As a Geshe is a degree, like he's a PhD, like a doctor of philosophy, something in the Tibetan monastic university tradition, from Drepung Gomang College, he was he had a Geshe degree, and he was very learned and so forth. So he had taught in Columbia University actually, but language, he taught the language there, in the Middle Eastern department before I knew him, and so he did, and he had a lot of private students and personal students like me. Eventually became his student, and he was a total earthquake for me. But his thing was, he was not really seeking to create an empire of Dharma centers. He really was there to benefit those who sought his help. He didn't think that everyone should be Buddhist either. He would tell people, go see your rabbi. You know, he would tell somebody, go back and help your mother. He didn't want to recruit people into being monks or nuns. He did not. Unless, I mean, he would not oppose it if it could be helpful to them. In my case, he knew I was sincerely wanted to be a monk, but he knew that I would not have the support. And I didn't have the kind of destiny to do that, because he was clairvoyant for sure. I know for a fact he was clairvoyant. Not by that I'm clairvoyant, I know that, but by the fact, way he intervened in different situations in my life, knowing exactly what was going on in my head. And he was a great person, and he was there. I actually said it all when the very first meeting I had with him, when I was leaving, having been sent off by him to go back and take up a job in India with Tibetan refugees there, and having a ticket in hand, but telling my friend who had driven me there to his little monastery in New Jersey, I'm coming back, I'm studying with this guy, I'm not going back to India until I've had a chance to study with him. This was my teacher. And the guy said, well, why? Why is that? You have a ticket to go back, Dalai Lama, Tibetan Lamas in India, blah, blah, blah. How come you're not doing that? Well, just we met this guy, he gave us a piece of pie, we talked to him. He needs some English teachers for his young monks. Why? And I said, no, on a spiritual level, he is my teacher. And then why? And I said, because he's not there himself. And what I meant by that, and I didn't, it just blurted it out, you know, and I didn't at the time, I think, really know what it meant, and maybe I still don't, but I have a little better sense of it than I did then. What it means is that, you know, I had been in a lot of religious things, Christian, Sufi, Hindu, and not so many Buddhist ones in Asia, but yet, because I was just getting started with them in India. But I'd been in a lot of places, and there are these holy gurus who are luminous sometimes. But then you feel you're a little nothing next to them, and they're all there about themselves, and how do you fit into their agenda is what you feel. And I was always suspicious of that. I wasn't wanting to enroll as a follower and a devotee, and I don't even want to be religious. I still am not that religious in what people normally think of as religious. I follow blindly and just think somebody else is going to solve my problem. I'm not. And I sensed that he didn't have an agenda for me, other than the one he articulated, which was that he was seeking an English teacher for his young lamas who had been sent to his little lamasery there in New Jersey in order to do, among other things, study more their own state studies, but also learn English, so the Dalai Lama could have them as interpreting monks. This was in the early 60s, you know, 62, you know. So I just knew that he was the kind of, and that's the nature of a Buddha. A Buddha doesn't manifest even a body in Buddhist theory, except to benefit beings who need to interact with that kind of body, who can't find the sort of subtle body, Obi-Wan Kenobi sort of Buddha, who would just sort of, you know, like send, be a rainbow in front of them or something like that. They need a person who's going to tell them, like, don't put your soy sauce, don't pig up the soy sauce. And begin to like chip away at their identity, self-indulgence and all this, you know, identity habit and self-preoccupation and self-cherishing habit. You know, someone who does that personally, that's really a needed thing, a great teacher like that. He was that kind of great teacher. And he was centrifugal as a teacher. People would come and he would serve them as best he could, and he would want them to get back into what he felt they really needed to do in life, their job or their family or whatever it was. You know, and be part of their community, which would might mean staying Christian, being Jewish, being Muslim. Not so many Muslim people visited him, but those who did, whoever it was, he had, or being secular. And he was like His Holiness, he was like that. So his significance is, I think, great in that sense still. And he's a kind of emanation, you could say, of the great Avalokiteshvara, like His Holiness. And he was certainly significant to me. The best piece of advice I've ever received from one of my teachers, well, I would say I daily receive the best piece of advice that I did get from my teacher, the Geshe Wangyal, that I have gotten and do periodically get from my teacher, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, from Lingzhan Rinpoche, from Pujan Rinpoche, from all my different, Serkon Rinpoche, my great Taro Tulku, all my favorite and wonderful, kind, Geshe Wangyal, great teachers. But nowadays I receive from my wife quite a lot, and a little bit from some of my children, about how to get over yourself, how to be less self-important, less self-involved, and how to be more aware and have a better time, because be more connected well to others, and be more selfless in action, as well as understanding philosophically selfless or meditationally selfless. And I get that advice all the time from my ultimate guru, which is my beloved wife, who teaches me that constantly. And that's the best piece of advice always, is be a wise selfish. The Dalai Lama, puts it as, if you're going to be successful, selfish even, be a wise selfish and be altruistic. It's so brilliant. It's right from Shantideva, right from Buddha. Because selfish means you want to be happy yourself. But as long as you're being selfish, you're always going to be evaluating where you are, and you're never going to be happy enough. So you're always going to be dissatisfied. So when you're altruistic, you begin to focus on whether others are doing well or not. And you bracket, or you put a little bit behind your attention. You divert your attention from your self situation to other situations. And that immediately makes you feel better. And then, because naturally we are meant to feel better. We are these amazing, gentle, intelligent, sensitive beings who have the type of soft skin that we do, who have the incredible intelligence that we do, in order to enjoy our presence in the relative world. That's actually the kind of being we are. But then we make it into a horrible torment and a struggle and fear and hatred and greed and envy and pride. And delusion and thing by misunderstanding what we are, actually, and by not understanding what we are, scientifically speaking. So therefore, we're afraid of our vulnerability and our sensitivity, which is actually our greatest asset. It's our greatest, that what enables us to understand our environment and our world and our life and its purpose is our sensitivity and intelligence. And being in a relative situation. So that's the constant advice I receive from my beloved family and friends, especially my beloved wife. Okay, my Dakini. Okay, thank you very much. All the best.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism Up Close and Personal with Robert Thurman during upcoming Tibet House U.S. trips with Geographic Expeditions. Trips in 2018 include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn about these Tibet House member trips and the benefits of becoming a monthly supporter, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.